Thank you, Anthony. I mean, how nice to be arriving, and you got a big welcoming hug for you. Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. I am Debbie Davis, and I'm an alcoholic. And wow, this trip has been so far, and it's not even over yet. Just amazing. Just amazing. My husband and I drove down because Gil had invited me. Gil started coming back up and visiting the Bay Area where I met him and where I currently live in Concord, and said, you know, how about coming down sometime? And it worked out. It was going to be this weekend. And so Kent and I drove down. We've had a blast just relaxing and doing fun bombing around town type things. And then I get here to the dinner, and I see Kathy, whose mother was a woman named Angie T. And boom, you know, once again, my emotional heart memory kicks in. And I'm thinking about Angie, and I'm just, you know, overwhelmed because I had the honor of giving her a cake. She was many years sober than me. And one day she came to where she often came to meetings, Bellflower Big Book Group, and asked me to give her a cake. I'm like, wow, I mean, there's a lot of people here, you know, maybe more deserving to give you a cake. And for years I gave her that cake. She was at our wedding. And we just recently watched our video, which we do every year. And again, seeing all the people who've gone to the big meeting, and Angie's one of them. And I'm sitting here at the break, and this lady comes up and says, do you recognize me? And I did not. And she identified herself as KB. Boom. Once again, emotional heart memory. And her husband, Mac, who gave me so many. I loved hearing his story. Never tired of hearing him talk. And I'll always remember he gave me this beautiful key of freedom. One of the times he talked at Bellflower, he was describing a situation where he had felt bad about making a mistake. And I had recently, or it had been some time since I'd made this mistake, and I was so ashamed of what I had done because I prided myself on my word meaning something. And if I said it, it was truth. And I remember this one particular time I told something that I was pretty sure was true, but it was going to be hurtful on the character of someone else because I didn't like that person. And I was so ashamed as it was coming out. You know, you wish you could, you know, take that back, and there is no taking back. And I made gone on to make the proper amends and stuff, but this is now a couple years later. I'm still feeling the twinge of feeling bad about that. And he was telling in his story how he'd gone to the meeting that night, and one of the longtime guys said, what's going on? Well, I'm feeling pretty bad. I made a mistake. Oh, okay. I mean, we all make mistakes. Did you make amends for it? Yeah. And you're still feeling bad? Yeah. That's your second mistake. And it gave me the freedom, whew, to finally let that go. Because I have a hard time being human. Making mistakes is a zero tolerance. And my husband just did a snicker. Because he knows how hard it is for me to make mistakes. We all do. I remember being 27 years sober and doing an inventory. And one of the resentments was about being human. And I know, I don't know if you relate to that or not, but it's like, and it's kind of funny and it's yet serious. It was like, Deb, you better get used to being human because you're going to be it the rest of your life, right? And I struggle with that. Now, I still do today, but not as long. It's the self-forgiveness comes more often. It doesn't mean I don't keep trying not to be hurtful or something, but that will come out. And so, you know, tonight's been just impressive. And then Gilbert, I mean, we can all go home. I don't need to say much. He's, if there isn't a story, a beautiful story of what someone used to be like how AA made that change and what he's like today. I mean, there, that says it all beautifully. Thank you very much, Gilbert. That was a beautiful share. And so that's what we get to do here. We get to share our experience, strength, and hope. Now, my story couldn't be more different than Gilbert's. And yet, here we are, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the beauty of AA to me, is that everyone in this room has a story to tell. And you'll be able to reach people I never could reach. Because, you see, we come from all different walks of life. I sat next to Robert tonight at dinner. Parents and 5 siblings and a son all died from alcoholism. He's the only one sober. Me, we shook the tree. Nothing came out except me. You know, I'm the only identified alcoholic in the family. We had a suspect uncle one time. Close as we got. Same with my husband's family. So how did we get the illness, the DNA, the genes? I don't know. But the good news is we know what we've got and we know what our solution is and we're in the middle of it. And so I was introduced to you through a treatment program in a little town called Grand Forks, North Dakota. All you do is drink in North Dakota. I mean, it's what else to do? In South Dakota, North Dakota, you drink. I mean, I never minded the cold. You didn't know it was cold, you know? I remember getting drug out of a snowbank I'd passed out, and, you know, that's the stuff that happens. And so I'm in this treatment program, and I know they've made a mistake. I mean, clearly. I am way too young to be an alcoholic because I know what they look like. I know what they are. They're old men in trench coats, okay? I'm not old, I'm not a man, and I don't own a trench coat. Do not qualify, right? But I didn't have a clue. I'm sure they explained it to me, but I did not have a clue what alcoholism was. My mind took events of your life and said, that then is alcoholism. So naturally, they encouraged me, they provided a lot of information, they encouraged me to find the similarities, but I would find the differences, and in my own small way, that 2 inches behind my belly button spot, I began to have the mustard seed of identification. And I've often thought, when the non-alcoholic hears our stories, maybe for the first time, that, you know, the things that we talk about and laugh about and nod about, relate to, are just beyond how anyone would think of doing that, could do it, would do it. It's so foreign to them. And yet for us, we're all sitting there relating and nodding and we identify. And so I heard you say things that I found the differences. I'd hear things like, I drank for 40 years. I thought, good, I got 35 more to go. Good, okay. I drank 7/5 of whiskey a day. I'm a whiskey drinker. That's a goal, right? I mean, so I'd hear you say, I lost my family because of drinking. Now, many of you thought that was a bad idea. I thought this was a score. I mean, I want to lose my family. God, what a source of irritation they are. Constantly about my drinking. Da, da, da. And yet, when that fog lifts, I realized that I'd been asked to leave their home because it was no longer a safe place for them. I remember reading in our big book in those early days about Jekyll and Hyde. And when I saw that, I really related to that personality swing. Now, the story, basically, Dr. Jekyll is, everybody loves him. He's well-loved in the community, respected. But he has a curiosity about the dark side. And he finds this potion that takes him there, but he can always come back when he wants to, but he's curious. He does things as Mr. Hyde He'd never do as Dr. Jekyll. But the time goes on where he can no longer control when he comes back, and eventually cannot until death. And then he reemerges as Dr. Jekyll, and oh my God, it was Dr. Jekyll. Well, I was that, but a little bit in reverse. I was that dark spirit inside in the non-drinking. It was that dark, it was the black and white. It's when I would think about homicide. I never thought about suicide, but I know some people that need to go. And so I'd think about that. And I took a potion called whiskey, and Dr. Jekyll within me emerges. The technicolor comes on. Everybody lives. We're all good, you know? Didn't mean it. You know, nothing escaped my voice. But it was that inside feeling. And I even knew about those swings. And I don't know how to identify it, but when I read Jekyll and Hyde, oh, yeah, I understand that. You talked about drunk driving charges, like Gilbert, 5 DUIs. Some of you should not do it. You're not very good at this. I didn't have any drunk driving charges because I had a little get-out-of-trouble card. It's called I Work for the City Judge. This helps. When you're picked up for underage drunk driving, I might add, I know the police, they know me, they take away my booze, maybe they have it later themselves, tell me to go home, and you know, sometimes I do. But most of the time, I just find some other dark alley and finish the drunk out. Because I've tried that to stop abruptly thing, it's not good. This is very painful, this is very difficult. And if you've ever done that, you know what I'm talking about. I had a girlfriend, she's still alive and with us, but there were 3 of us that drank exactly like, one is dead from alcoholism, the other 2 of us are sober, and then this one was a non-alcoholic. And she would say, hey, you want to go out for a beer? Well, okay, she really meant one, okay? For people like us, that's code for let's go get so schnockered we can't get off the ground, right? It's never literally a beer, but for her it was. So you had to know that. If I could not finish the drinking after I left her, I didn't even start. You see, I don't know about the phenomenon of craving and the allergy, but I do know that once I start, I want to finish and be drunk. I want to take it the whole route, not just the teaser route. But I don't know that in language, in words, but I know that in feeling. I heard you talk about totaling out cars. Okay, once again, I have never totaled out a car officially. Now, I had a little drunk car because I drink and drive. And that's the kind, you know, when you buy them, they're rectangular, okay? They start that way. And then when you're dry, I know you know this, things just jump out in front of you from nowhere. You know, they just reappear, things, a car was not there just a moment ago, and now it is. And your car gets rounded out in the drunk bumps, and, you know, round becomes oval. Your things are missing, they're falling off, they're broken. My driver's window had been shot out. You'd think I'd know when that happened. My gas cap was a mitten I had stuck in there because I lost the gas cap somewhere. I'm resourceful. Mittens work. Gas caps are drinking money. I mean, I'm like driving a Molotov cocktail around, you know, and it gets a shrug, basically, right? And we don't think anything of that. I heard you talk about losing jobs. Now, let's be clear. My jobs were drinking money producers. They were not career starters. They're not, I'm going to go up some ladder. They were just simply a way to get money to drink. Because I had tried, you know, I'm not anyone with ambition. I'm not an entrepreneur, but I had a moment that I thought I had some ambition. And I was going to be a drug dealer. Now, I know you can totally understand that and see that picture. I know it. I know I fit the bill, right? And so, but there's a problem. I was my only customer. So therein lies the problem. So that went the way. So I need some legitimate taxpaying kind of little work to produce some money to drink. And yes, okay, well, maybe I did get fired from a few. Maybe I did quit before I got fired. You know how we know how to do that. And then I started in that last year of quitting in a blackout. And this is a problem because you don't know you quit, so you go to work the next day. You know, hello. And you're hungover, but by God, you go to work, alcohol, you know. And they're like surprised. You don't know why they're surprised you're there. You kind of put those pieces together. Oh, yes, that's right. I quit last night. And you slink away like the goofball that you are. And then I heard those women talk about their years of prostitution. I thought, you can get paid for that? You know, I was like, geez, I could have had a little side job, right? You know, a little spare money. And I would hear these things. My case is different. But that 2 inches behind my belly button spot, I began to identify. There were a couple things I heard that bothered me. One was they talked about all the broken promises. How do you know about those? I began to realize I hadn't been able to keep one of those promises to anybody, let alone certainly not my father, who was always extracting another promise after the lecture. I knew I would mess up again. I'm just sorry that you have to witness that and be hurt by it. Because I would tell myself the big fat lie. I'm only hurting myself. And how many people we infect and affect with our drinking. And then I heard a woman talk about trying to scrub away the smell. That got my attention. I've had this funny odor for about a year, and I don't know what it is. I've tried to puff and powder and perfume it away, and it's just like there. And when she said, standing at a podium like this, front of the room, sharing her experience, strength, and hope, that she's an alcoholic, that was booze coming through her pores, and she doesn't drink anymore, I knew that she knew what the smell smelled like. And I thought, if I'm not careful, I might be one of those people. That's as close as I got. I was in that 4-week program 7 weeks, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I'm sent to an all-women's halfway house in Minneapolis. I'm going to be there a total of 9 months, but the first 7 months I did the bare bones minimum. Don't drink. It's kind of obvious people are trying to put their life back together, and I knew it included all those other things. And go to one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting a month. When you're not working, you can kind of fit that in. So I fit in my one meeting a month, but I'm not going to give it much. I walked in when it started, left when it was over, got her done. Here's the piece of paper signed Halfway House. There you go. I mean, I could have cared less. I am just going through a few motions required to stay there. My intent, get below their radar, they being my father and all people watching me, so I can slither back to the way I was living before, which was drinking every day, but don't confuse that with what the alcoholics do. I just like to drink, have fun, party, blah, 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 right? And 7 months go by, and I went to visit my mother, who lived in San Jose, California at the time. I'm there 2.5 weeks. First week, I'm hanging out with the people I used to drink with. Last weekend, half drunk and loaded with them. No surprise. You see, I had done zero to protect my physical sobriety, to lay and create a foundation with a higher power. That there was no relationship there between me and the first drink. There was nothing. I knew I would drink again. I always knew I would drink again. I knew when I heard you say you were done, you were desperate, you'd surrendered, all those kinds of phrases, I intellectually knew what you were talking about, but I knew I hadn't felt that. I knew that was not of my experience at the time, because I knew I would drink again. So everything had a wall in front of it. I pick up that drink, and while I have no idea what it wasn't, didn't matter. While the me picking up the drink was no surprise, the drinking was. Because for 7 months, I'd been living in that fantasy world of the booze, the boys, the bars, woo, that all that fun going on. And it couldn't have been any more different. I picked up that unknown drink of alcohol. I mean, knowing it was alcohol, I just don't know what it was. I didn't care. Didn't matter. And I picked up that drink, had a couple of whatever that was, and my next recall is on the flight home a week and a half later. I have never had a week and a half memory lapse. Lie detector, I could not have told you what happened. But when I was on that flight home, I had this, whew, boy, I've learned my lesson. That scared me. And all I did then for the next 5 weeks was I bumped it up from one meeting a month to one a week. Nothing else changed. 5 weeks later, on a Friday, I got a letter in the mail from one of these friends in California, and it had one joint in it. Now, there's no point in this story if it had no point. I mean, if it was just a run-of-the-mill day. But little did I know the significance this would have in my life, literally life-changing. And so I get this one joint in the mail, and I decided to keep it because I thought, you just never know when you might need something like this, right? Now, keep in mind, back in the day, pot at that time was just garbage, right? It was sticks and stems and seeds, and everything's got a burn mark within a 3-foot radius. Your hair, your clothes, your carpet, your everything is just god awful crap. But we thought we were so cool, you know, and I decided to keep it. It was an omen. I didn't go looking for it. It just came to me, right? Well, in case I need it someday, well, by gosh, I needed it the next day. And it just was amazing, the timing on that. You know me, the minute I open that up, the cartoon, boing. You know, I'm like plotting and planning when I'm going to smoke this, where, blah, 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 blah. So Saturday comes and I've got my plan all set up. And this, little to my knowledge, would be when I would have what Dr. Silkworth basically calls the psychic change. And what that meant to me is the more I read that page, the psychic change is on there 3 times. The more I read it, it just makes me so aware that this came into my life just like it did in the description of the man he talks about, hopeless and never seeming to solve his problem. This is a poor analogy of it. Just please read it yourself. That never overcoming them. And something happens where he's now seemingly able to live life without alcohol and successfully and moving on. And it doesn't say what he did or what happened, but there was a psychic change. Before I lit that match, I had no intention whatsoever of changing anything I was doing in my life. I didn't think to myself, you know, this is going to be the very, very last ever. And then I'm going to jump right into AA. I'm going to go to meeting every day. I'm going to get a bunch of highlighters and highlight my book like I've been reading it. I'm getting one of those sponsor people. You know, and do, I don't know what they do, but, you know, have coffee or something. I mean, just, that did not cross my mind. This was going to be one more lie. Pot doesn't count, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does, just so you know. I've talked to so many people who stopped the booze but kept smoking pot thinking they were sober. They're not sober. When I'm altered in any fashion, my definition of sobriety is gone. And that is my foundation here. And I had no intention of doing anything different. There's going to be one more lie, one more attitude of it's none of their business. When I have that attitude, even today, it's like, whoa, whoa. What are you doing you shouldn't be doing? That's always kind of that foundation question to ask myself. So I lit that match and the conflict began. By the time it was over, it was so great within me that the two voices that we have on our shoulder were in yelling at each other. And it was like, it finally was like a bomb just dropped inside of me, just boom, and the and it like leveled all of the excuses, the yeah buts, the I knows, the leave me alones, the you don't understands, the my case is different, leveled them. And it wasn't by invitation, but I knew that moment was some kind of a spiritual divine gift, whatever you want to call it, and I better hold on to it. I want to hold on to it. Being loaded was like repulsive to me. The back door I had left wide open for the just in cases was sealed up. And I had this weird magnetic pull to these people in AA. They seemed to know how to live life. And I do not. And I know I don't. And I'm admitting for the first time, I don't. That night I would admit for my very first time to my innermost self, chapter 3's words came alive to me that I'm an alcoholic. It was the first time I'd also admit the willingness to listen to somebody else. And so I went, I was sober all that Sunday, and I went to the meeting. I decided to go early, and I went 20 minutes early, and so I was like, my God, I feel like I'm going the day before. You know, it's like, who goes 20 minutes early? Well, most of my home group, you know, you're familiar with it too. 20 minutes early is late. In my home group, where you been? We're on our second cup of coffee. You know, we've been here a while. Because we have to be there for that new face that walks in the door. They may have had their last drink in the parking lot or 500 years sober. I don't know, but I've never met them. And I want them to have a warm experience, welcoming experience at my home group. Just as if it was theirs. And so I went there early and I had a new experience. I heard the music, what we call the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never heard that. You won't hear that when you walk in on time or when it starts or late. You will not hear that. You've just cheated yourself out of this beautiful music. And when I would leave immediately, same thing. The laughter, the carrying on, the chitter chatter. Wow. And I felt the heartbeat, the warmth of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, when you walk in when it starts or late, you don't feel that. Because everybody's like you, sitting down respectfully, waiting for the message to be carried. And I had this new experience of watching hugs and back pats and handshakes, the greetings. Wow. And so I went to those long timers and I said, so what do you do to stay sober? She's asking a question. We probably should give her an answer, right? And they did. They gave me what I call the formula for success. Now we have, all of us have just been through the same experience and coming out of isolation, COVID, you know, restrictions, etc. And for some people that really dampened their spirit. We got a little lazy, got a little too comfortable just going from one room to the next. But I know that for myself, I can't afford to stay there. I must be with you. Now, there's going to be reasons where people can't due to health considerations and so forth. But if you're not feeling lit up, whether you're online or in person, check that out. Why? I can't afford not to be lit up about AA and my recovery. If it is gray, I'm not staying. I will not be here. And so here were the things they shared with me that have continued to light me up on the inside. So they said to me that one day at a time, we don't take the first drink. And I knew it meant all those other things. And we get a sobriety date. If I'm not physically sober, nothing's going to stick. It's that proverbial Teflon wall throwing spaghetti at it. It's going to, you know, nothing's going to happen there. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'm all in. I know I'm all in. Not part way, not conditionally. I'm all in. Today's as good a day as any. I took that as my sobriety date. And that's February 8, 1976. It's still my sobriety date. I've been with you for over 47 years and still in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it almost feels like I'm lying when I tell you that. Because really, how can you be 47 years sober when you're 39 years old? At some point the numbers start going backwards, okay? But it just doesn't feel like I got my first drink at 12, my last at 18. I've been here 47 years. It's just amazing to me the life I get to live on the inside and on the freedom on the outside as well. And so that's my sobriety date. But I've had them before. What's the difference? The rest of the things they shared with me. They said that we go to a lot of meetings and we get a home group. Now, I've been blessed from the beginning, didn't know it, but blessed from the beginning to have three legacy groups as my home groups. What do I mean by that? I mean that they were actively engaged in the 12 steps of recovery. They were very familiar and adhered to the 12 traditions. And they had representation in general service as a GSR or inner group or service and service functions. That was my exposure. They were an active group who did things. And so I've been blessed with those kinds of groups from the beginning. I've lived in four different cities in the United States, and so far that's the only reason I've changed home groups is I just left the community. Doesn't mean I haven't wanted to. And I know it's not always easy. Sometimes it's very difficult in really small communities. But there's always been people that, how do I say, I know would be happier in another home group, okay? I never tell them that. I just think it. But I'm always, always very kind and say hello to every single person in my group. Like them or not, they'll never know. That's important to me. And so four cities, four home groups. And I realized when I moved up to Northern California to Mary Kent, I've also had four different last names. But that's just kind of that side story, you know, that goes with it. So my home group is the primary purpose group, Monday nights. We are now at 7 o'clock. We moved up an hour just May 8 of this year, and it has been my home group for over 22 years. And I'm a very invested, active, in the middle member of that group. I'm not an attender. I'm not a visitor. I am a member. I'm in the middle of that group. And I've been all three in AA. Member is always a better feeling. I was told that we get a sponsor, or if you're unfamiliar with that term, it's like a mentor. I've been blessed with four amazing sponsors. I had Marguerite in Minneapolis. I had Joe in Atlanta. I had a woman named Millie in Southern California. And when I moved to Northern, I kept her, and we were together 33 years. And when she died, and I got the word at 7 a.m. on that Friday morning that she had passed around 2:25, I waited 2 hours before I called my current sponsor, Marilyn, to set an appointment to talk to her about sponsorship. You see, I was 43 years sober at that time. I probably know what's going on. I probably don't need hand-holding, but I do need a sponsor. I choose to have someone to be accountable to. There's no demand. But I'm the winner when I do. It keeps me in a state that I am not the end of the road in my life. I have someone to take this to. I don't have to figure it out, and probably shouldn't be the one to figure it out. I'm trying to find a solution with the problem. And so I have been actively sponsored by Marilyn for over 3 years now. I also sponsor, and I'm what I call a three legacy sponsor, where I take the people I work with through the steps and the traditions and the concepts. We have three legacies, not one. And I feel like if I only gave them the one, I'd be cheating them out of being a worldwide informed member of AA. And that's just me. That's, you know, not everybody's interested in that, but that's how I do sponsorship. And I'm blessed to work with the people that I get to work with. So sponsorship. They said, take the steps. We take the steps. And I use that verb specifically because that's what chapter 5 says. Here are the steps we took. You're ready to take certain steps. Because it kind of has this different action to me. It's like vitamins. I take vitamins internally. I take the steps for the internal change as well. And so by taking these steps, in the beginning you were handed a book. Here, read it. Thank God I went to a book study and a step study on a regular basis, because sponsors didn't do what we've evolved to doing. Most in the 70s and 80s did not do that, where they sit down knee to knee and you walk through the book together. It's somewhat explained to you. You talk about it. That's evolved. Now, you might be sober longer than me and had a different experience, but for the many years, my sponsors never had that done to them, so they didn't do it. And when we say you sponsor like you've been sponsored, that can be a very, very good thing. But I know if I stuck to that technically, my gang would never go through all three legacies. And when I was about 11 years sober, I decided to sponsor the way I wanted to be sponsored. And I began to take them through all three legacies myself using our literature. So I sponsor as well. But the taking of the steps, I know that I did my best. And I was about 4 years sober when I moved to Atlanta. And I got a sponsor locked in, got a home group locked in, took a 4-year birthday cake, and there was this click in my mind that said, you know, you're 4 years sober now. You know something. Oh, my God. Boy, don't listen to your head when it says you know something. That's about the time you should be running to your sponsor about this information. And I decided 7 meetings a week's a lot of meetings. Now, in a new community, that's a perfect amount of meetings to get to know your new community. But no. I got a case of the lazy butt. And so 7 meetings a week sounded like a lot of work. I'm going to go to 2 or 3, which quickly became 2. And over the next 2 years, instead of being one of the earliest people to arrive at the meeting, I'm now 5 minutes before the meeting at 6 years sober. 4 years when I arrive, one of the last people to leave, 6 years, 2 years later at 6 years, it's amen, shake, shake. I'm out the door. I'd gone from member to attender and now to that visitor, get her done kind of thing again. And after I take that 6-year cake, I am so restless, irritable, and discontented. Don't know why. It's called a severe case of untreated alcoholism. I had not been in service. I had not been treating it with our principles and applying this and investing myself in AA. I'm checking boxes now. It's off my to-do list this week. Got her done. I don't see that, but I came up with a plan. I came up with a plan. People, places, and things are going to make me happy. Now it's called men, money, and mansions are going to make me happy, right? So I'm on a mission. And I'm a little fella, and we're in this whirlwind romance, which I was the only one involved, but I'm in this whirlwind romance of 3 months of insanity within myself, and oh my God, it's hideous. And he goes off and marries somebody else, so I let him go. And then you just kind of scan the room, it felt like, and up pops another little fella. And he was sober a long time, did this dance of delusion 3 months, and he married somebody else. And I'm like, I am marrying off more people than you can. I have married off many people. The next person they dated, they got married. So I should get credit for that, I guess. I don't know. So I at 6.9 years of sobriety, I just came crashing in. Now, mind you, I never stopped sitting in the rooms because I was too afraid not to. But I was so far removed from center and didn't know why. So I came skidding in spiritually, emotionally, and mentally, just broke. Physically, still sober intact. But that wasn't going to be too much longer. You see, we're so fortunate to have a place to go because we're coming up on our 88th birthday. 88, there's people older than 88 years. And when they were born, there was no solution. There was no hope. There was no meeting on every corner as we have today. Morning, noon, nighttime, late night meetings every day of the week that we have. There wasn't anything for them. And yet I knew where to go. And I recommitted myself to AA. I reread our literature as if I'd never read it before and took those steps as if I'd never seen them before. And when I got to step 12, it doesn't say, now start over and do more analysis and more writing. It says, hey, you've had a spiritual awakening. Why don't you get out there and help somebody else have one too? And that's what sponsorship is about. And I don't have to be somebody's sponsor to offer to take them through the big book. Oftentimes it might become that. But it was about carrying someone else through now that I've had that experience, not just selfishly, well, I got mine, hope you get yours. No, no. The light on the inside happens when I help someone else. They said those traditions, those aren't just for the group. That you're a part of a group. You need to know how they apply at the group level. And oh, by the way, why don't you see how you can apply them in your personal life? I brought selfish, self-serving, self, all about me into the rooms, whether it's friendships or relationships. And when I finally picked up that spiritual kit, that spiritual tool in the kit box, I began to realize that there's other people in here besides me. The mirror came down from my face to see there's other people in here, that it, common welfare, what are my welfare? That's how I'd seen it. Group conscience, no, it's my way or the highway, baby. Singleness of purpose, autonomy, outside issues, opinions, self-support. Yes, you're welcome to support me. I mean, you know, these kinds of things. I had no clue about what that looked like at a personal level. These, to me, have been the greatest tools to be able to have new, grown-up, adult relationships with other people. They said, we are of service. Now, having a commitment in my home group wasn't an option. You had one, even if you had to make one up, you had a commitment. Because I'm a taker. And they said, no, that's done now. You have to find a way to be a giver. No more of that taking. And so that is what they did. But what they were talking about service-wise was the stuff outside the convenience of the home group, like intergroup, H&I, general service. I could list many different committees and services that we always need help with. It just takes effort outside of my comfort zone. And so they said that we're of service. For me, the service is when I'm asked to speak somewhere at 6 a.m. in the morning. Now that is service beyond any length, let me tell you. I do not wake up and look like this, okay? This takes focus. I might as well stay up all night sometimes because I got to get up so early. It takes coffee, it's scheduling, and you got to be alert. You can't just be, you know, sleepwalking through this. So that to me is service, let me tell you. And my hair's never awake by that time, but I'm present and camera ready, as we say. And so that kind of service is very important to me because it's so what I don't want to do. And yet a lot of those meetings end up being ones coming up in a Ukraine, as it like the country, Ukraine Treatment Center. Next Friday morning, 6 a.m. my time. As much as I don't like getting up that early, I feel so honored to be able to carry the message of hope and recovery to the men and women that are in there. I don't know what they get. I don't know what they hear. Like Gilbert said, he had misinformation from misinformed people. I don't know what they're getting, but I know I will get the opportunity to share and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery to them. And the last thing they said was, carry the message. You know, wherever it may be, whether it's in a group of one, a group of many, every one of us has a message to carry. And I think the things that they shared with me are the greatest message I can pass on to you. So to recap, a sobriety date that's honest. You know it's honest. You know it's dishonest. A home group that you're an active member in. A sponsor, as we often say here, who knows they're your sponsor. Yeah. Not one of those, I got one of those things. You know, they know you. They don't say Debbie who, right? That you've taken all of the steps, not just the ones you like. Yeah, and if you've gotten some nine-step amends left, good time to get after those. To look at those traditions in a new light as the group and also in your personal life. To be of service. Look for opportunities where you can be of service instead of being that taker. How can I be the giver? And to carry your message to anyone who reaches out their hand. Thank you so much for having me tonight. Great to be with you.